The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly from The Guardian. I'm Alex Kwiatkowski, and on this week's podcast, we're looking at how the UK government is coping with an impressive influx of cyber attacks and how other governments around the world propose to protect themselves. We're also looking at the first steps towards copyright reform. The Hargreaves Report is released this week, and the recommendations of the Government Commission's study is expected to ruffle a few industry feathers. And finally, in the roundup of UK government headlines, we discuss how the appointment of the US's chief technology officer to the UK government will affect our attitudes to open data. Joining me to pick apart these issues are Charles Arthur, The Guardian's technology editor, and Ruslan Kogan, a serial e-entrepreneur. Welcome to the podcast, Ruslan. Apparently you're going to space.
I am a little bit later this year on Richard Branson's Virgin Galactic, so they're just running through a few final tests at the moment, so I'm in no rush. I'll let them take care of those, and I'm very excited about it.
How far into space?
How awesome.
How long for?
Space, wow.
Yeah.
Do you have to go and fix the International Space Station? Is that like, you know, this is how you pay your bills? Is it like washing the dishes in restaurants?
Indentured servitude.
I'm just mainly doing it to rack up some frequent flyer miles, but yeah, it's all up about a 3.5-hour trip.
Wow, so it's more obviously than a parabolic flight, but do you get to go on the Vomit Comet?
No, we don't, but we get, as part of the trip, there's about 10 minutes of weightlessness, so I'll be sure to take up a packet of M&Ms or something and do the whole float around and try and get used to the weightlessness and see how it goes.
That's awesome. Charles, do we have any money in the technology budget for a field trip to space?
Well, what I was actually thinking more of is one of those indoor things where you can go and do indoor paragliding. You know, I think we could just about stretch to that.
Sweet! I think we should speak with the producer of the podcast to see if we can record that, because that could be some good sound. Also this week, Google has announced their latest assault on the Microsoft megalith with the details of their Chromebook, a new piece of kit that uses the data cloud to store your stuff and Google's operating system to process it. Keep listening for the next 30 minutes of Tech Weekly from The Guardian. First in this week's news, Chancellor George Osborne revealed that Whitehall is the target of up to 20,000 cyber attacks per month, and that the Treasury is the most targeted department in the government.
Now, of course, this age of digitised public services creates challenges as well as opportunities. There's the challenge of ensuring the security of personal data and financial information, for example. The hacking into Sony's online PlayStation network, the theft of millions of users' credit card details, is a high-profile example of the need for robust online security. This applies equally to government as to the private sector. In any given month, there are over 20,000 malicious emails sent to government networks. And here is a salient story from the year that I've been Chancellor. We have seen, during the last year, hostile intelligence agencies make hundreds of serious and pre-planned attempts to break into the Treasury's computer system. In fact, it averaged out at more than one attempt per day. But we're not taking this challenge lying down. And at the spending review last year, when we had to take lots of difficult decisions with the government budget, we announced we would invest £650 million in our new national cyber security programme to enhance our online security.
Osborne, speaking at the Google Zeitgeist conference this week, revealed that the email system receives malicious communications at an alarming rate, but that their malware system expertly blocks the majority. Now, Charles, I think the key question here is what kind of malware scanner do they use, and is it publicly available?
Well, I believe it is actually a commercial version, though I haven't been able to confirm precisely which company does do it, and possibly they'll leap into the comments and tell us. But the malware is delivered through an attachment. So it might look like an Excel file, it might look like a Word file, and instead it will exploit perhaps a flash vulnerability. That's quite a common route for doing this, or a PDF vulnerability. So it looks like it's an Office attachment. Actually, it exploits an Adobe vulnerability, and that will give them control of the machine, or you know, access or a backdoor into the machine. Other things that can happen sometimes is that people are sent to a web link and there's a drive-by download onto the machine using a browser zero-day vulnerability.
So how? Why are they specifically? Because in Osborne's speech, he was talking about how the Treasury, in particular, is being attacked. Why is that? Is that simply people wanting to get? You know,
it's like when Jesse James, the famous bank robber, was. There was a journalist who sort of went along with Jesse James and said, why is it you keep on, you know, robbing banks, Jesse, you know, when you could have a quiet life sort of doing other stuff? And he said, that's where all the money is.
Hey.
And it's, again, it's precisely the same with the Treasury. You know, this sort of attack, the sort of attack that George Osborne was talking about, was carried out successfully against the French Foreign Ministry ahead of the, and the French Treasury, I believe, ahead of the G20 summit last year, which is believed to have been driven by intelligence agencies working perhaps on behalf of China because they could see some trade benefits from it in knowing what the other side's negotiating position is.
Very interesting. So it turns more strategic than opposed to sort of money grubbing or trying to crack a fort, you know, crack into Fort Knox.
It's much more about that because it's much more about knowing what is the negotiating position of the other side. It's not as if you sort of break into the Treasury web servers and then suddenly, hey, I've got lots of money. It's not really like that. It's about information.
Well, the news this week of the cyber attacks comes at the same time as the U.S. White House proposed new legislation for their internal cybersecurity strategy. Rather than imposing top-down regulations for private companies to install protections against cyber attacks, they hope that companies will innovate themselves to provide security solutions that can be used nationally in the U.S. and globally. Now, Charles, do you know what this legislation says?
Well, there's a proposal in front of the U.S. Houses of Representatives and Senate, which is it's in Congress at the moment, which is House of Representatives. National data breach reporting, which is that companies have to report about breaches, change the way that computer crime is brought under the criminal statute so that it would actually fall under RICO, the Racketeering Influenced and Corrupt Organizations Act, which is the one they use to get the mafia and other people. At the moment, cybercrime doesn't fall under RICO, and RICO is the biggest weapon that the FBI really has. So changing that would be quite a big change. And then they're talking about providing voluntary government assistance to industry, states, local government when there's a cyber attack, voluntary information sharing between industry, states, local government, and also what they call critical infrastructure cybersecurity plans, which is very much strengthening things like essential services, electricity, power, you know, water, all these sorts of things, actually having much stronger cyber defenses on those.
The actual process of protecting themselves, the companies, the private companies protecting themselves. One thing that I got out of the piece that you wrote was that it is very much a, as I say, it's not a top down. It's not saying you must do this, you must install this, but it's sort of servicing themselves in many ways. It's providing their own solutions for this. Now, won't this create a fragmented marketplace? Won't this actually sort of create a non-strategic overview where there are more loopholes?
The difficulty is if you do it from the top down, then it takes time while everyone goes, well, what's the best way to do it? And everyone dithers about it. You try to get a unified standard, and then the unified standard will have holes in it anyway. You know, the best argument, the best model in security is to have a really heterogeneous community so that you have lots of people who have different ways of doing it. Yeah, there will be weak ones who'll get targeted, but the hope is that as they get targeted, as they realize that they're being targeted, they'll move to a stronger model.
The UK will be getting an insider's perspective on US's cyber strategy with the appointment of former US CTO and open government champion Beth Novick on the advisory team for Tech City, number 10's proposed proposition to encourage innovation in the creative technology sector. Tech Weekly spoke with Novick in 2010 when she was at the Guardian's Activate Summit, and here's a flavor of what she will bring to the position.
Data sets by itself are not that interesting. What's exciting is the ability for people to connect around information and to do things with that information. We've been here a little bit longer than this government, so we have been in conversation with folks in the Cabinet Office at Number 10. And of course, as I mentioned earlier, data.gov and data.gov.uk provide, I think, a healthy competition for one another, a race to the top in an effort to see who can outdo each other putting more data sets up online.
That was Beth Novick, who it was announced this week has been recruited to the UK government. Welcome, Beth. Now, Charles, what is Beth expected to bring to the government's open data proposition? Because this has been something that she's been fighting for within the US for a long time.
The expectation is that she's going to show how to open up the government databases and expose more, if you like, the APIs, so that developers can really get their hooks into them and build new and interesting services on top of them. George Osborne, in his speech at Google Zeitgeist, was making the point that if you deliver a service, a public service, using conventional office things over the phone or someone dealing with a piece of paper, it costs you £10. If you do it digitally, it costs you £2. And for a government that's looking to save every penny it possibly can, there's an obvious benefit there. So he's talking about making public services available digitally as a default, and having office versions of, you know, sort of the conventional paper-based ones. The minister would have to have a very, very good reason for why that was done rather than digital one. So what Beth Novick is expected to do is to really drive that through, to go through government and get these databases, these services sort of exposed, so that all the government departments are thinking about how do we make this digital. It's a difficult task, has to be said, but, you know, she's the sort of person who one would expect to be able to do it.
It'll give a lot more accountability to the government. In a private business like Kogan, we are all metrics-driven, and every single employee is accountable, and we monitor all the performance and the statistics, and this will make it easy to calculate and see how well is money being used. And it means that people and voters and the people whose hard-earned taxpayer money is being spent will be able to make better decisions in terms of how well is the government performing, and do we want to vote them in or do we want another alternative.
And what is it? What is this position in Australia?
In Australia, it's like a lot of governments around the world, where they release certain information but others stays behind closed doors, and we do all have all sorts of Freedom of Information Acts, but it makes it near impossible to get hold of any of that information.
Now, Charles, Beth, when we spoke with Beth at the Activate Summit, we also spoke with Martha Lane Fox, who's the UK's digital champion. It sounds to me like their remits are pretty similar. Where's the overlap going to be, and how can they keep the two roles distinct?
Martha Lane Fox is driving the whole digital agenda. Her position, which should be said, you know, she's not being paid for, she's doing it because she thinks it's the right thing to do, is to get everyone online and to really push through the whole digital agenda. So she's not competing with Beth Novick. Beth Novick is sort of doing something in parallel inside government, whereas Martha Lane Fox's sort of aim is more outside government, is interacting with the citizens. So in that sense, their roles are complementary. But also, Martha Lane Fox is someone who can get things done, and she's very effective at that. So with Martha Lane Fox and Beth Novick, and, you know, the people like Tim Kelsey, Tom Steinberg, who are inside the Cabinet Office now, you start to see actually that there's a real kernel of people who can drive through the open data movement.
In more government news, the Hargreaves Report on Intellectual Property, which was commissioned by the Prime Minister in November, is expected to be released this week. And it's also expected to urge the government to create a new system of exchange for digital rights, which some suggest is the first step in widespread copyright reform. Now, Charles, what do we know about the Hargreaves Report?
Some of it has started to leak out ahead of the publication, which is expected on Wednesday. It's really trying to look at... I'd hate to sort of say it's fiddling around the edges, but there's not an enormous amount that the government here can do without having to refer back to the European Union, and the because copyright comes under a European framework. So we can sort of do our own little things here inside the UK about how do we slightly better implement copyright law, but there's not a great deal. So what has leaked out ahead so far is that there would be new laws which would allow parody. Allow you to use original content in order to create parody.
But so I have
to
say, sort of mashing things up. It's sort of saying sort of mashups are
yeah.
okay.
So the classic one is after New York State of Mind, which was Alicia Keys and Jay-Z's great song of last year. There was a viral version, which was Newport State of Mind, which is all, you know, out of Wales. But Alicia Keys and Jay-Z protested and didn't like it, and so they got it taken down from YouTube. I have to say, I thought actually you were allowed to do that already. It was that it fell under, you know, fair dealing. as the UK has it, which is, you know, you're allowed to satirise or do other things with copyrighted work. But anyway, Hargreaves is suggesting that parody be explicitly allowed to go ahead. He's also talking about an online rights exchange, which I thought had already been, we'd sort of gone around that lighthouse with Stephen Carter with the Digital Britain report slightly more than a year ago, when in the sort of the part one version, he said, yeah, this is what we're going to do. We're going to have a Digital Britain and blah, blah, blah. That vanished from the final Digital Britain report. So I don't quite see why Ian Hargreaves thinks that it's going to be so fantastic to have an intellectual property exchange, a one-stop shop where you can clear the use of copyrighted content. I sort of thought this, you know, that was sort of extant already. And the problem isn't about clearing the use of copyrighted content. It's more the fact that that people like Spotify, We7, especially the digital music people, have to deal with different territories. So what we do in the UK is not going to make a great deal of difference. It's the fact that you have to deal with lots of different territories that screws things up.
It doesn't actually sound like this is pushing things forward or is going to be the great reformer.
The great reform we're hoping to see out of it is that people will be allowed legally to rip their CDs onto their iPods, which at the moment is not legal. You know, and everyone says, really? Well, what have I been doing for the past 10 years? I'm a criminal, arrest me.
Everything possible has to be done to protect IP as much as possible, because one trend we're going through at the moment is that, you know, everyone recognizes that stealing someone's property is wrong, and, you know, going up and stealing your pen or taking your phone is a bad thing. But what people aren't catching on with as much is that there's a lot of virtual intellectual property being created at the moment with concepts and ideas, like, you know, you have your Facebooks and your music and things like that, and there's a great amount of creativity that goes into it. And as a business person, you want to see that sort of creativity happen as much as possible. And the only way you're going to do that is by finding an adequate way to protect people's ideas and to protect creativity. If you built an awesome house and put a lot of time and effort and energy into it, knowing that someone could just walk along with a gun the next day and take it off you, you would not have put so much time and energy into building a great house. And so I think that as we move more and more into the digital age, it's very important to concentrate on how will we protect intellectual property to ensure that people are incentivized to keep coming up with great ideas.
We're expecting the Hargreaves report out later this week. And finally, in the news this week, several netbook manufacturers announced that they were exclusively shipping their new hardware with Google Chrome operating system rather than Microsoft's Windows. Samsung and Acer will be building the machines, which will, Google says, boot up in 8 seconds and be malware-free and available to businesses and education customers on a low-cost lease basis. Now, Charles, will this have any effect on Microsoft's Windows and Office monopolies?
Well, this is what people have been expecting for a long time from Google, is that it is actually going to park its tanks on Microsoft's lawn and start taking aim. The thing here is you have to look at the numbers. So every year you get about 400 million PCs shipped. And out of those, PCs tend to be replaced about once every 3 years or so. So about 150 million PCs are, by my calculation, I may have this wrong, but I think I'm right, about 150 million of those are being replaced every year. Google says it has 3 million businesses with about 30 million business users using its Google Docs suite. So that's about one-fifth, you know, 30 million PCs perhaps that might get replaced every year. Those would be your prime candidates to use Chrome OS. That starts to chip away at Microsoft, I think, especially if the if Google starts to get into more places, Google Docs starts to get used more widely, because Microsoft's money from Windows and Office is very closely tied to the number of PCs that are shipped. So when the number of PCs shipped fell in the first quarter of this year, Microsoft's Windows income fell quite dramatically. Office isn't so closely tied because Microsoft makes money in other ways from that. It can sell to existing PCs, but when there's not new PCs being sold, then Microsoft loses on Windows. There is, of course, the question of whether people will shift to Google Docs and then Microsoft doesn't get the Office money either. So, again, it starts to chip away. It's not a big difference. And, you know, 30 million out of 400 million isn't going to make a big difference to begin with. But you can see that it's the sort of thing that will just start to nibble away and could be dangerous.
Ruslan, is this a really... important shift, because it seems that the trend really is moving towards tablets as opposed to netbooks, for example.
Yeah. It's a huge shift in the way that we view a computer. And yes, in the early stages, it's only a small market share, but I'm sure that's what Yahoo said 15 years ago when Google came along as well. The biggest shift is in thinking, and the first implementation we're going to see is in the corporate world, because what's happened up until now, companies have said, look, all our computers have to use Windows because it saves us a lot of money in training. It means a new person comes along, they already know how to use this computer. All of a sudden, with this new way of thinking, everything's in the cloud. As long as you've got an internet browser, every application's going to look the same. Every interaction's going to look the same. And it's going to save people a lot of money on training, and it's also going to save a lot of money on infrastructure and keeping all of this running. People are already very familiar to having a lot of their services and applications in the cloud. People are already using Gmail and Hotmail and other services to store their email. They're already using Flickr and Picasa to store their photos. They're already using Facebook and Twitter for their social interactions and all of their contacts. So people already have all their info in the cloud. What Google is doing is saying, look, your computer user experience is as simple as having a browser and using cloud-based software that will look exactly the same no matter what sort of computer you use. It also means if you use your computer, just pick up another computer, start an internet browser, and you've got the same applications, the same software, you're ready to go again. And I think that that's a very important step towards the future of computing.
It's interesting, this idea that people are already using the cloud so much. I would argue that most people don't realize that they're using the cloud, and that this kind of interaction with effectively a terminal, a non-personal terminal, you know, wherever you are, you can, as you say, pick up, you can log on and you can head in. That, I think, is going to be quite a leap for the consumer. Don't you think, to recognize and to start using things like Docs and these other systems that people are very, they feel a protection over, and they want to keep close to them on their own machines.
Yeah, but the fact that they've already sort of made this leap without even realizing it, I think means that that is definitely the way in which it's going. These days, if you look at the most common apps used on a computer, it's going to be the internet browser. And you know, people barely touch anything else. They're streaming all their video through the internet browser. They're doing all of their interactions through the internet browser. They're playing Flash games through the internet browser. It's all happening within the internet browser. And the whole concept of any internet browser you load becomes your computer is a great one, because, for instance, even at Kogan, we're a completely cloud-based business. If our office burns down tonight, we're ready to go at any internet cafe tomorrow morning with zero downtime. And that's a huge advantage to business.
Now, Charles, this does ring true in very personal experiences, unfortunately, but this does ring true, this notion of using the browser and having access to the browser. You know, there were all kinds of op-ed pieces recently suggesting that the browser was dead. Google's move into this space, into the netbook space, seems to counteract it.
I've got to say, they're not netbooks. It's not, you know, they're netbooks in the sense that they're completely about the net, but they're not netbooks as in small screen. These are 12-inch screens, so these are, you know, in that sense, they're proper notebook, if you like, laptop-sized screens. It's simply that they're amazingly cut down. They've got very little onboard storage. I think it's a couple of gigabytes. The operating system is not quite burnt in, but it's near enough so that it does a checksum when it starts up. If it finds that the checksum doesn't agree with what it should be compared to what Google says it should be, then it says, whoa, got some malware here, and it just basically wipes itself and reloads the OS from Google. And it can do an update. Google's talking about doing an update every 6 weeks. Because it's a very small kernel, basically all it needs to do is run a browser. That's easy to do. So I think the antivirus companies are going to have to look to their laurels. They're going to have to figure out, well, what quite are we defending against? Because if you have, you know, imagine you've got the situation with the Treasury and the cyber attacks. The email comes in, it's got this attachment. What does the attachment run against? You know, it gets downloaded, you don't download it. It sits on the web. So what vulnerability does it exploit? Maybe it exploits a flash vulnerability, but then that has to be a flash vulnerability against the version of the browser that you're using, and it has to do it in a way that it's quite difficult. Yeah.
Well, keep on top of this story and the rest of this week's news at guardian.co.uk/technology. Ruslan Kogan, you've been with us for the whole podcast, but now the spotlight turns on you. You are a serial entrepreneur with a new business model for e-commerce. Tell me a bit about it.
Yeah, well, the business model has been up and running in Australia for 5 years. We only just launched it in the UK. Essentially, it's a manufacturer direct-to-consumer business model, selling all the latest technology that people want. So things like LCD and LED TVs, GPSs, Blu-rays, netbooks. We at Kogan manufacture these products based on Google data that shows us how many people are searching for what and what products are in mass demand. We then engage consumers in social media to get them to say, well, exactly what features do you want to see in these products? Then we have the products manufactured, shipped direct to Australia and the UK in containers, and then distributed, delivered to anywhere that people want them. And the main competitive advantage is obviously the price. We're able to shatter the price barrier of what our competitors like your Samsungs and Sonys and Apples are doing, but also we can implement some features that others haven't even thought of.
Can you give me an example? I mean, at the minute, what it sounds to me like is you're acting in many ways like Gateway. You remember Gateway when they first came out? You know, here's a sort of built-to-purpose piece of kit.
One example would be we're the only LED TV with built-in Blu-ray player on the UK market at the moment. Now, the reason for that being that your big brands like your Sonys and Samsungs, they've been trying to push their 3D TV offering. We've looked at what are people searching for in Google, and we've seen that although 3D TVs are selling, that's purely because a lot of TVs just happen to have the 3D feature built in, not because people are looking for 3D TV. Google search data shows us that there's 7 times more people looking for a TV with built-in Blu-ray player than 3D TV, and there's 21 times more people looking for a TV with built-in PVR that lets you pause and rewind live TV than are looking for 3D TV. So what have we done? We've gone and built those products.
Is there any way that the big guns can compete with this? Because what it feels like is that you're doing a lot of made-to-order. You're responding to trends, not just big companies, but you know, small company competition is probably quite difficult because you can't necessarily have the production line at your disposal to produce either the quantity or even have the surplus that is needed at a given moment in the consumer's desires.
Over 5 years, we've grown so quickly that we're dealing with some of the world's biggest manufacturers at the moment, and we've got a lot of say in how our products work and what we put into them, and we can get products to market very quickly. Can others do it? Certainly. We love competition. That's what gets us out of bed in the morning. So the more people that try and do it, the better, and the consumer's going to be the ultimate winner. But at this stage, even the big guys aren't doing it.
I sort of get the impression it's a bit like the difference between a supertanker and a sort of yacht, that the big companies are the supertankers, so they go in one direction and it's really hard for them to turn, and you're the yacht, you can turn more quickly. But equally, they can cover a hell of a lot of ground and they can carry far more. Your carriage is limited. Is that a way of typifying it, that you have to sort of keep chopping and changing?
Yeah, look, you're certainly right. We're a very agile company. So, and the big guys are much bigger than us at this stage. But based on our current growth, in 5 or so years, we'll overtake the big guys.
Because how big are you now? What's your turnover now?
Turnover for this year will be close to probably more than the $50 million mark. And that's based on turnover of $300,000 5 years ago.
That's Australian dollars we're talking
yes.
about?
Yes. So based on that sort of growth, we could be the size of an LG or a Samsung within 5 years. The whole using the internet to gain great intelligence, sell direct to the consumer and smash the competition on price is a new way of thinking. And we think that some of the big brands will move in that direction as well. We think that not enough of them are selling direct online at the moment, and a lot of them are starting to develop a presence in the social media and their blogs and things like that. So I think we're creating a good trend in that regard. Traditionally, these big companies, they would hold focus groups and discussion groups and trying to ascertain what do people want and what do customers think. They'd use a table of 10 people to judge what 5 million people want. And in those discussions, one outspoken person would say something and the other 9 sheep would copy. We're using exact facts and data about the marketplace, information that's only recently become available. It's a lot easier to do in the online virtual space than it is to do when you've committed to hundreds of retail stores around the country. So,
Charles, giving people exactly what they want isn't necessarily inspiring for innovation, though, is it? How? What other ways can you see this type of model sort of moving forward or shifting things, changing the e-commerce landscape?
The difficulty is that you do tend to be what's called a fast follower. You know, so you can be really good at coming up with something that's quite like something that already exists. It's very difficult to create something that doesn't yet exist, to imagine, you know, the iPad, to take the iPod into... Yeah, there were MP3 players before the iPod, but what Apple did was to say, wait a minute, very small disc, we could make something that's very different in terms of what the experience is like. So the difficulty, I suppose you could call it, is that, you know, you're not going to be known for innovation, but it gives you that agility, you know, it makes you the yacht. And there's lots of money to be made in that. You know, Dell has done pretty well out of, you know, being the fast follower in PCs and doing the BTO sort of thing.
Are you happy not being the innovator, but being the fast follower?
We do not plan on creating demand or innovating new products. We plan on innovating new ways to deliver those products for a better price. Kogan is there to service demand. We need to see demand for a certain category first. We've done a lot of innovation in the way that we can service that market and deliver those products for cheaper. A lot of it happens internally that customers don't get to see, like our paperless office and things like that, and the fact that the whole business operates in the cloud and getting things delivered for cheaper through those internal efficiencies.
Are there other revolutions in the e-commerce market that you can point to? Is this one of them?
I think this is the most interesting sort of way of going about deciding what you want to build. Because, you know, if you come down to it, generally the money is in hardware. It's hard to be really successful in software. It has the benefit that, you know, with software you make one, you can sell a million, but selling the million is the hard thing. So where are the big revolutions? I don't know. There must be someone out there who's thinking of the next way to go.
Yeah, I think the biggest revolution in e-commerce and retail at the moment is the whole customization aspect of treating every single customer as an individual. If you walk into a John Lewis or a Currys, they assume that every single person is the same. They've got a fixed layout for their store. There's companies at the moment like Hunch.com and Boutiques.com that are all about customization. If you go onto Hunch.com, you answer a few questions, and they're questions like, do you want your toast sliced vertically or diagonally? Do you sometimes drive with the windows open and the air conditioner on? And you spend 5 minutes answering these questions. It profiles you to know that it knew the only book I've read in the last year and the only 3 TV shows I've watched. I've shown some girlfriends boutiques.com, which does a similar thing. It shows you 2 outfits and it says, which one's more you? And they click on one of them and then it does that again. And then you click on which outfit's more you. You do this about 20 or 30 times and then it learns your taste and generates a catalog based on things that it knows you'll love. And my friends have been like, you know, they, for them, shopping's like an experience rather than the shopping. It's like, what are you doing Sunday? Just shopping. And they'd look at it and go, oh my God, this is like someone's done 6 months of shopping for me and they've known what are the absolute best items I would have picked out. You know, imagine you walk into the store and they greet you at the front saying, hello, we've got 600,000 dresses in store. We've looked through every single one for you. Here are the 3 that we'll know you like. So this whole customized shopping experience, understanding your consumer and treating every single visitor to your website like an individual with unique needs is the next revolution happening in e-commerce and online retail at the moment.
Well, you can be treated like an individual at kogan.co.uk and also kogan.com.au. Well, that's it for this week. Thank you very much to our podcast guests, Ruslan Kogan and, of course, Charles Arthur. The podcast this week was produced by Scott Colley. I'm Alex Kratowski. We'll be back next Tuesday. See you then.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.